This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
ABC Radio National. Hello again, I'm Robin Williams, and in today's science show, nuclear power rides again. We wonder whether climate change actually triggered civilization, and we talk to the children. Well, nuclear power has become a likely option. It could be affordable and it could be safe, we're told. This was ABC Television News last weekend.
The Prime Minister says Australia would be foolish to ignore nuclear power. Federal government task forces found that a nuclear power industry could be commercially viable within 15 years. The task force head, former Telstra boss Ziggy Switkowski, isn't due to publish his report for 2 weeks, but its findings have been leaked.
The Prime Minister has been warming to nuclear power as part of the cure for greenhouse gas emissions. Now John Howard's Energy Task Force is set to endorse his position.
I believe that the world's attitude towards nuclear power is changing. I believe that Australian attitudes towards nuclear power are changing. Nuclear power is potentially the cleanest and the greenest of them all.
Ziggy Switkowski's report won't be out for a fortnight, but the government today confirmed what it says will be the key findings.
We're seeing reports like the Switkowski report, which will indicate that nuclear energy will be competitive with low emission coal within 15 years.
The Nuclear Power Association agrees it will be feasible by then, but only with government support.
At the moment, it may appear that you can't compete with cheap coal. But if you were to put a penalty on carbon emissions, then the price would have to go up.
Advocates say there's room for a nuclear power plant in the New South Wales Hunter Valley, in North Queensland and Western Australia. But awkward questions about where to put the plants are expected to be left out of the Switkowski report. David Spicer, ABC News.
So suddenly it's on, at least as a debate. So what are the options? Robin Grimes is a good man to ask. He's just scored a sizeable grant to examine Generation 4 of the nuclear power stations. But the first thing you see in his office at Imperial College in London are some mouldy-looking specimens he's just got through the post.
Well, hopefully not mouldy, but they're certainly radioactive minerals, which I just bought through the post in England for, £10 for one and, that was £21 for the other one. One of them's got thorium in it, which is a weak alpha emitter, and one's got uranium in it, so uranium phosphate, both of them natural minerals. So clearly you can send them through the post, because if they're natural, they can't be doing any harm, can they?
Well, I'm sure not, but were you surprised to be able to get them so easily?
Well, I think it's interesting to compare how easy it is to get these really actually genuinely innocuous but very, very slightly radioactive minerals through the post. If those were materials from a licensed nuclear site, you absolutely would not be able to send anything like that through the post. The security issues and the safety issues surrounding nuclear materials from nuclear reactor sites, reprocessing sites like that, are extremely strict in Britain and, in fact, around the world.
And is it not true that dear old granite similarly has got nuclear properties? And even Brazil nuts?
I'm not sure about the Brazil nuts. I mean, that must be the potassium in them, which makes me a little nervous about eating Brazil nuts because I rather like them, actually. But certainly granite, it's true to say that if you go on holiday in the UK down to Devon and Cornwall, you will get something like twice your annual dose that you would get in London just from a 2-week holiday.
And by implication, you're suggesting that the care that we take with the nuclear power industry, which is, just over 50 years old, really, in Britain, the care that we take is too far?
No, I don't think it's too far. What I'm really trying to illustrate to you is that it's very strict. I think it's good that it's very strict. I certainly wouldn't think that it should be getting any stricter, but I think we can gain a certain amount of comfort from the level of strictness.
Of course, the strictness makes it extremely expensive, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, that's absolutely right. Yes, it is more expensive, but I'll put the question to you. Aren't you glad that it's that strict?
Robin Grimes is Professor of Materials Physics at Imperial College in London. And yes, we welcome strict safety regulations, of course. But why are attitudes so different in France and Sweden, where nuclear is seen almost as green as opposed to the UK or here in Australia? Robin Grimes.
Well, of course, in Australia you've not had any nuclear reactors per se, although of course you produce an awful lot of uranium, and you've done some fantastic work on dealing with the nuclear waste. This is the SynRoc. If you haven't been familiar with reactors, how are you supposed to know how safe they are?
Well, what's your opinion about their safety now? Not necessarily this present generation, but the next generation.
The present generation are actually very safe in terms of the Western reactors. Obviously, there were issues, and it would be silly to say that there weren't, in some of the Eastern European reactors. But in the West, we really have an excellent safety record. But the new reactors are going to be even safer. The sort of ethos that's being developed for the new generations of reactors is that they should have passive safety features. And this means that in the, as they say, unlikely event, which means that if something awful happens that was completely unforeseen, but they've no idea what that could be, but nevertheless, if that were to happen, instead of the reactor going into a situation where it would melt down or something dramatic would happen from an engineering point of view, it slowly, naturally assumes a safe position. So you won't get a Three Mile Island type accident, you would not get the sort of Chernobyl-like accident.
Well, you've got, as you said, something like thorium in front of you, and in fact, on the Science Show a few weeks back, the editor of Cosmos, Wilson De Silva, had a cover story about the potential of thorium-based reactors. What's your opinion of that technology?
Thorium is something that we're going to be hearing a lot more about. Part of this is because India has large thorium deposits, but it doesn't have large uranium deposits, and therefore they see themselves as being self-sufficient if they can create a reactor system which is based on their own natural reserves of thorium. Thorium does have certain advantages over uranium cycle at the end point because it's much more proliferation resistant. It's not completely proliferation resistant, and the International Atomic Energy Agency will be overseeing any thorium reactor just like uranium reactor. But the trouble with a thorium cycle is that the making of the fuel in the first place is a little bit more difficult because thorium's slightly more radioactive than uranium.
So what's the difficulty? What's the problem about it?
Well, when you make a uranium-based fuel, it's so unradioactive before it's been in a reactor that, frankly, we could sit in this room with some fuel pins in complete safety. You would hardly be able to detect the radiation at all, so long as that it was in its shielding. With a thorium-based fuel, you'd have to have some barriers between you and it. And, you know, you're making tons and tons of fuel. That additional safety is increasing the costs.
Now, what's your programme? You've got £6 million or more to look at the future safety programme. What does that kind of work consist of?
Well, first of all, I suppose like any academic, I'm going to tell you that £6 million is actually not a very large amount of money when you're trying to do nuclear work. I'm sure you've never heard that sort of thing before.
It's nearly 20 million bucks.
Yeah, well, OK, but when you're dealing with nuclear materials, they are very expensive, as we said right at the beginning. What we're trying to do is try to develop the scientific basis of understanding which will help the new generation of reactor systems. And we're not just talking about the sort that we're going to be building in the UK with any luck in the next 5 to 10 years, but actually looking even further ahead than that to sort of 30, 40 years to the so-called Generation 4 reactors.
What will they be like, those Generation 4 reactors? You know, what could we look forward to if it all goes well?
Well, if we go back to this idea of a passive safety system, the Generation 4 reactors will all have a completely passive response to any unforeseen accident. You're looking at reactors which are probably going to be of higher temperature. They're probably going to be gas-cooled. And we're probably going to be in the position to be able to use the excess heat from those reactors to generate hydrogen or other useful chemicals.
And the waste?
If your reactor works to a higher burn-up, so you put the fuel in for much, much longer, so again, we're going to have to redesign the fuel, and that's also part of our interests, then the amount of waste you get is necessarily that much lower. You twice the burn-up, half the amount of waste for the same amount of kilowatts.
Well, you're very cheery about the prospect. Any doubts, lingering doubts in your private moments?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's going to be crucial to get the public on board. If the public do not feel confident that the necessary safety, the necessary engineering has been done, they're not going to vote for this, and there aren't going to be any reactors. So public understanding, public acceptance is going to be crucial.
And if the Generation 4 do come online,
How much of the country's needs do you think could be serviced from that?
We're in a position where we have a number of nuclear licensed sites in the UK. These are the old Magnox reactors, which are pretty close to being all shut down now. They've just got a few left in operation. If you replaced those existing licensed nuclear sites with new reactors, then we could produce at least a third, maybe 40% of our electricity from nuclear without any problem whatsoever.
And very little CO2 while they're operating.
Very little indeed. It's not true to say that nuclear is carbon-free, because, of course, you have to mine the stuff in the first place, you've got to transport lots of building materials, you've got to produce the concrete, but the amount of CO2 you produce per kilowatt-hour is similar to wind, tidal and other forms of low CO2 generating.
The next generation of nuclear power stations. Robin Grimes is Professor of Materials Physics at Imperial College in London, and he's examining their likely performance. All this, of course, a response to our ever-growing concerns about climate. Attitudes are changing rapidly. And here with a summary of what's been happening in his country is John Rennie, Editor-in-Chief of Scientific American.
With virtually every new climate study that appears in the scientific literature, the fact of global warming caused by industrial greenhouse gases becomes harder to deny. Uncertainties still surround the eventual extent and consequences of rising temperatures, but it waxes increasingly ludicrous for anyone to insist that anthropogenic climate change is in doubt. Similarly, one can debate what the best policy responses should be, but it seems ever less responsible to counsel that governments should do nothing to slow the accumulation of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. Policy prescriptions for global warming are sometimes touted as a choice between trying to prevent climate change and learning to adapt to it, but most projections suggest that we will really need to do both. Frustratingly, here in the United States, the federal government has been resistant to taking up forcefully the cause of prevention. Back during Bill Clinton's administration, the Senate rejected the Kyoto Treaty, and over the past 6 years, George W. Bush and the Republican-controlled Congress have consistently favored letting industry reduce its CO2 emissions voluntarily. However, in a fascinating development, lawmakers at the state level, particularly those in California, are now moving to take the lead on climate change policy. In August, the California legislature approved a bill calling for a 25% cut in emissions of greenhouse gases by the year 2020. Other states have pledged to make similar cuts, but California is the first to mandate emission limits. That proposal won the support of both California's Democrat-controlled legislature and Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. On the other hand, California's State Chamber of Commerce opposed the bill, claiming that it would have no significant effect on global climate because polluting businesses would simply relocate to a different state. That argument is based on a questionable assumption, however, that curbing greenhouse gases is forbiddingly expensive, so expensive that it can chase away industries that would otherwise succumb to California's sunny charms. In fact, improving the energy efficiency of a factory or an office building can both slash carbon release and save money at the same time. And thanks to recent technological advances, electricity generated from renewable energy sources, wind turbines, solar thermal systems, geothermal facilities, and so on, is becoming more economically competitive with power produced by burning coal or natural gas. Pacific Gas and Electric, one of the biggest utilities in California, broke with the rest of its industry by supporting the emission limits. The company currently generates 12% of its electricity from renewable sources, excluding large hydroelectric plants, and plans to increase that share to 20% by 2010. Perhaps the biggest boon of the new California law is that it will encourage other states to take their own stands against global warming. Some time ago, 7 northeastern states, Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, and Vermont, banded together to implement a regional greenhouse gas initiative. The governors of those states have already agreed to lower their greenhouse gas emissions by 10% by 2019. More recently, a dozen states have joined a federal lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency, arguing that the Clean Air Act requires the agency to regulate greenhouse gases. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule on that case next year. But the federal courts may frustrate the states' efforts rather than further them. In 2002, California enacted a law calling for a 30% cut in the greenhouse gas emissions from cars and trucks sold in the state. 2 years later, trade groups representing the auto industry filed a lawsuit claiming that the pending regulations are illegal because they effectively mandate an improvement in fuel economy, and only the federal government has the power to set those standards. Such are the odd twists when the federal government takes a less active role in protecting citizens from environmental catastrophes than the states do. At the end of former Vice President Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, the well-received documentary about global warming that appeared in theaters this past summer, the filmmakers provided a list of practical steps that anyone can take to tackle this looming environmental problem. The most memorable suggestion was this one. Vote for leaders who pledge to solve this crisis. Write to Congress. If they don't listen, run for Congress. Given the midterm elections that shook up the balance of power in Washington this past week, we may find out just how many moviegoers took that advice.
Rather a lot, it would seem. John Rennie is editor-in-chief of Scientific American. And there is one spectacularly technological answer to global warming, which comes from Arizona this week, something that erupts now and then in different forms. It's a way to cover the sky in some kind of shade to reduce sunlight. In 1979, Freeman Dyson suggested particles should be sent up. Edward Teller revived the idea in 1998. And now Roger Angel is proposing a sunshade far, far away in orbit to do the job. He's with David Fisher.
There's a natural point where you can orbit something which will, once you've got it there, will stay on a line between the Earth and the Sun. It's 1.5 million kilometres from the Earth.
Just to give people some idea, the average distance to the Moon, I think, is about 380,000 kilometres. So this orbit is beyond the Moon.
Yeah, it's about four times more distant than the Moon. And it's about 1% of the way towards the Sun.
It's a long way out.
Yeah, it's a long way out, but it turns out there that if you put something small there, then the shadow, it creates a penumbra that's about the size of the Earth. So most of the sunlight that you block with something there actually is light that would have got to the Earth one way or another.
So what are you proposing to put at that point in that orbit?
Well, the first thing I did to figure out was what was the sort of lightest material that you could put there that would actually get rid of the sunlight. And it turns out it's not a mirror that would send the light back to the sun. It's a thin, transparent sort of glass sheet, if you like, or a film that's only a micron thick, much thinner than food wrap. But it's kind of imprinted with a pattern that instead of letting the light straight through, deviates it by a couple of degrees. And that's enough that it will miss the Earth. So any light that goes through the screen keeps going through, but it just gets bent enough to miss the Earth. And it's about, as I say, a micron thick, but the area you need, that's 2% of the area of the Earth, means that it's several million square kilometers, and it's going to weigh about 20 million tons. So one of the problems you've got to solve is how to get so much mass from the Earth to the L1 point. And then the other problem is how you're going to hold it there and what kind of screen you're going to make out of it.
Presumably 20 million tons is orders of magnitude greater than anything we've put into space or put into orbit before.
Yeah, for instance, in the Apollo missions, each mission sent about 50 tons towards the moon. So there were half a dozen of them. So a few hundred tons were sent in the direction of the moon. And now I need 20 million. So it's a lot more mass. And in fact, it looks like rockets would be impossibly expensive. But there is a launching technique that's never been developed. It didn't really have a good reason. But there's a magnetic launch, which is a bit like maglev trains, which float and go a horizontal track. But you can use the same technique to drive something up a vertical track. And if you drive it hard enough, you can make it leave the Earth and head, you know, in the direction of L1.
It sounds, though, with that technique, you'd need an awful lot of them. They wouldn't individually be that heavy, but you need a lot.
Yeah, you need 16 trillion. and each one weighs a gram, which is about the same as a big butterfly. And I would stack them up till you've got about a ton of them, which is about a million. And they're very thin, so that would be a stack a few meters high. And then you would launch those a million at a time. And even then, you have to launch every 5 minutes for 10 years with 20 separate launches, and then you would get the mass up there.
So this is no quick fix.
It's not a quick fix, but it's something that from the day you got really serious about it, it might take you 20, 25 years. And in the meantime, if things look bad, you could probably be putting sulfur in the atmosphere to give a temporary fix.
So if you get the go-ahead to design, to build and deploy, is your idea to actually get going on this or to stand by and wait for some extreme climate position to be reached?
Well, status of it now is various people have thought about it over the last 20 years. I've tried to put it in engineering and dollar terms, I've got a grant for $70,000, which will let me go a little bit further. But what I would like to see, quite honestly, now is NASA take this seriously. They spend $15 billion a year. So if they put, you know, $500 million or $1 billion a year into this, then in a few years, we would have a very much better understanding of whether it's real and what it would cost and how to do it. So I would think as an insurance investment, understanding how this could actually be done and fleshing it out, and that would actually be worth doing. My background is in astronomy, and the budget for doing space science experiments is about $5 billion a year from NASA. So I think putting some fraction of that into learning how to do this properly would be interesting. One thing that struck me, actually, is that ventures into space, really in some sense, Apollo took rocket launches about as far as it's theoretically possible. And if we had a space freight launcher, which is what this magnetic thing would be, that could actually transform all of our endeavors in space. So I don't think it would be wasted to learn how to do that, even if in the end, as I hope, you know, you won't need to do this, that we haven't reached a tipping point, but so it wouldn't be wasted research.
Let's imagine your idea goes ahead and it's hugely successful, and sometime down the track the Earth goes into a period of cooling. How would you get the disks down again?
Well, it's not a problem. In fact, you have to work quite hard to keep them in a line. Although the things will orbit if they're exactly in the right spot, turns out if you wobble them off a little bit, then they very soon get out of the line. So the problem is much more actually holding the things in line than how to get them off. But in the event that you decided things were cooling, it would be easy to command them to move off the line, which would mean moving sideways by a few thousand miles. And you could just park them there if you want. And then if you ever need them back again, if you made a mistake, you could move them back.
So what's the total cost?
Total cost is $5 trillion, but it's not so bad as you might think, because they should last up there for 50 years. So the sort of average cost per year is about $100 billion. And with reference, say, to the world economy, that's about 0.2% of global income. And it's, you know, the price of the Iraq War or something. So even one nation like the U.S. could actually afford something like that.
It's not as if you need a drawn-out Kyoto-style agreement.
Well, I think you would surely, and this will be true of any solutions, I think, to global warming. Obviously, it's a global problem, and certainly there seems to be a lot of awareness around the globe that, you know, this is potentially just a huge problem.
The trillion-dollar answer from Professor Roger Angel at the University of Arizona, talking to David Fisher. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, where we are also celebrating 50 years of Auntie's telly. One of those who spent decades on television, though his background is biology, is David Smith. Here's his reflection on recent events.
Almost 20 years ago, during filming for Earthwatch on ABC TV, I stood knee-deep in water in a semi-submerged office constructed 20 metres offshore at Williamstown, near Melbourne. The point of the exercise? To drive home in a graphic, if deliberately tongue-in-cheek way, the seriousness of possible implications of global warming. If sea level rose by an average of 2 metres, I said, as my secretary, Meredith Abbott, swam in with a cup of tea, this would be the result. I had discovered during research for the series, and also for the series Nature of Australia, that Australian scientists such as CSIRO's Dr. Barry Pittock and many others were becoming increasingly concerned at the consequences of what they saw all those years ago as the reality of global warming. My many interviews and readings of this scientific research compelled me to try and help bring the message to a wider audience. I distilled more than 5 years of research into a book and documentary titled, aptly in my view, Continent in Crisis. At that time, back in the mid to late 80s, I had perhaps naively assumed that documentaries and books could help raise awareness among the general public of the absolute urgency of finding ways to offset global warming and its potentially catastrophic consequences. In part, I was correct, and was certainly in good company. In the book Hearts and Minds, Creative Australians and the Environment, Michael Pollack and Margaret McNabb show how the creative input of a large group of writers, artists, poets and filmmakers, including Peter Garrett and Tim Flannery, has indeed been influential in shifting public perceptions of the environment towards sympathy and concern. Such a shift is not only welcome, but essential. My naivety was in expecting similar shifts of attitude among business leaders and politicians. In recent weeks, following the release of Britain's Review on the Economics of Climate Change by Sir Nicholas Stern, there has been a surge in reporting about climate change and its possible consequences. The reason this has sparked interest among politicians and some business people seems to be the conclusion that expenditure on countering global warming will not amount to a cost, but to a saving of billions of dollars, as the potentially dire effects of melting ice caps, rising sea levels, and shifting rainfall patterns are offset. But why is it that our business and political leaders only sniff trouble when there are dollars involved? I believe the answer lies in the failure of human societies, of whatever political persuasion, to grasp the reality that humans are an integral part of the living world, not in any way separate from it. For hundreds, possibly thousands of years, we've turned our backs on our underlying biology, and this has had critical consequences. Now we've reached payback time. In the mid-1800s, the French physiologist Claude Bernard wrote eloquently about what he termed the milieu interne, by which he meant the internal chemical environment of our bodies. Walter Cannon took this further, introducing the doctrine of homeostasis, whereby, despite external variations, the chemical composition of our cells and their bathing fluids is normally maintained within remarkably close tolerances. Over the past century, it became ever clearer that whether we're speaking about the internal workings of our bodies, or about the dynamics of how whole populations or ecosystems operate, in biology, steady states are the norm. Too great a deviation from the steady state leads inevitably to death. James Lovelock attempted to encapsulate this notion of planetary homeostasis in his Gaia hypothesis, and physiologists have long understood the importance of the body's internal regulatory systems and have gained great insights into how they achieve the regulation of blood pressure, tissue oxygenation, glucose levels, and all those other myriad variables which, if left unregulated, will surely kill us. As our society has developed, we have progressively uncoupled ourselves from our underlying biology. In our writings and musings, we have seen ourselves as different to the animals, and certainly superior to them, placing ourselves with no hint of modesty at the top of the evolutionary tree. The greater the divergence between us and our biology, the more important has our technology become in bridging the ever-widening gap. Thus, we've remained comfortable with the scheme of things, even though the environmental cost of this technological band-aid has been increasing exponentially. Why do we continue living as though we were not a part of nature? One of the root causes has to do with the rise to global dominance of the market economy and its underpinning assumptions and prerequisites, one of which is continuous growth. Even in his recent impassioned writings, scientist Tim Flannery has found it necessary to rely on market forces, in this case carbon trading, to produce continued development, productivity, and future wealth. I think Flannery is partly correct in this, but his argument doesn't go anywhere near far enough. At a deeper level, we should be thinking about how and why global warming has come about, and why we have been so reticent to address it. If our economic theories rely absolutely on the assumption of continuous economic growth, and yet we live on a planet in which continuous growth is plainly impossible, then our economic theories must be seen as being fatally flawed. This, of course, seems almost comically divorced from reality, but it's not. We need, as a matter of the utmost urgency, to seek out ways by which our human society can recouple itself with our underlying biology and work towards operating the way the rest of the planet does, ultimately achieving a societal and economic steady state. Interestingly, Anne and Paul Ehrlich, authors of the 1968 book The Population Bomb, have recently added their voices to the debate by pointing up the possible benefits, economic and otherwise, of a declining world population. Far from creating the catastrophe forecast by our economists, whose theories are really about as primitive in a predictive sense as was the theory of blood flow prior to William Harvey, negative growth may be a very good thing indeed, enabling us to move more swiftly to a truly sustainable steady-state society. Just as inappropriate use of fresh water is coming to be seen as profligate, even criminal, so societal models that cannot operate in the absence of continued growth will also come to be seen as highly inappropriate and destined for the scrap heap. Plant and animal populations frequently demonstrate local boom and bust cycles, where herbivores eat themselves out of vegetation, or booming carnivore populations eat themselves out of house and home. In such situations, the consequences for both individual animals and populations can be severe. It may be that global warming, by signalling the onset of a major catastrophe, is offering humanity an opportunity, indeed an imperative, to radically rethink its priorities. If we can achieve that, and do so in time, then the climate crisis may actually have been a very good thing indeed. With extreme predictions of 25-metre sea level increases following polar ice cap melting, perhaps we should have filmed the office scene at Williamstown completely underwater.
David Smith, now a filmmaker, he once lectured in zoology at the University of Melbourne. In fact, this week CSIRO produced a report suggesting that converting to sustainability in the face of climate change is affordable and wouldn't knock normal enterprise severely. Then there was this entrepreneur, Rupert Murdoch, making an unexpected declaration for taking the matter seriously, as reported on AM on ABC Radio National on Wednesday.
The world appears to have a new, albeit reluctant, eco-warrior. Rupert Murdoch, the head of international media giant News Corporation, has put himself firmly in the camp of those worried about the consequences of a rise in global temperatures. Mr. Murdoch says he's not convinced about what's to blame for the rise in temperatures, but he says something has to be done. Tokyo correspondent Shane McLeod reports.
Rupert Murdoch concedes to being a reluctant global warming convert.
I have to admit that until recently, I was somewhat wary of the warming debate. But I believe it is now our responsibility to take the lead on this issue.
The News Corporation chief was speaking in Tokyo at a forum organised by the publisher of the world's best-selling newspaper, Japan's Yomiuri Shimbun, daily circulation 10 million. But it wasn't dead trees Mr. Murdoch was worried about. More predictions of the dire consequences of global warming.
Some of the assumptions about extreme weather, whether it be hurricanes or drought, may seem far-fetched to us today. But what is certain is that temperatures have been rising and that we are not entirely sure of the consequences. And the planet deserves the benefit of the doubt.
While being a confirmed latecomer to the debate, Mr. Murdoch says his company is already taking up the challenge. Signs of a change of direction have been on display for months. The British Sun newspaper famously announced in September that its readers should go green with the sun, and the news satellite TV company BSkyB has made itself carbon neutral, with Mr. Murdoch's son James at the helm.
He has proved that being environmentally sound is not sentimentality. It is a sound business strategy and an example that the whole of our company, News Corporation, is now striving to emulate.
But going green doesn't mean embracing everything about climate change. Rupert Murdoch says the Kyoto Protocol doesn't go far enough because it doesn't include China and India. And he's not fully convinced that humans are to blame for the increasing temperatures.
We've got to at least take the insurance that the people who say so might be right. And the world certainly is warming. How much of it is warming due to human error is open to debate.
Mr. Murdoch says there won't be a successful response to global warming without the corporate world being on side. This is Shane McLeod in Tokyo for AM.
Who'd have thought? And who'd have thought that climate change, way back, could well have been the impetus for the start of civilization? That's the finding of Nick Brooks from the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change at the University of East Anglia.
OK, well, if we go back 10,000 years, we're looking to the beginnings of what we call the Holocene period, which is what most people think of as a period of benign, stable climatic conditions. And this is around about the time of the development of agriculture. We have to wait another 3,000 or 4,000 years before we start seeing the beginnings of civilization. And the first pristine civilizations, as they're often called, all emerged between about 4,000 and 6,000 years ago, with a clustering around about 3,000 BC, if we look at Egypt and civilizations of the Indus Valley and northern South America, etc. And these were preceded by the Sumerian civilization. Now, this period, we now know from climatic environmental studies, was actually a period of quite a lot of climatic hardship. all across the monsoon belt of the northern hemisphere, we're seeing increasing aridity as the monsoons retreat and weaken as a consequence of global scale changes in climate driven by orbital variations.
Do you mean we had monsoons here in Europe?
Not here in Europe, but we're talking about places like the Sahara, the Middle East, places where we have monsoons today, but if we go back sort of 5,000-6,000 years, they were much further north. So the Sahara and Alps are a hyper-arid desert, used to be watered by monsoon rainfall, and it was covered in lakes, rivers, savanna and open woodland. And this pattern was repeated across what's currently the arid desert belt of the Old World.
And so how did that really push people to live in bigger communities, in towns?
Well, as the landscapes dried up, people who previously would have roamed fairly freely across the landscape as either hunter-gatherers or herders or perhaps lived in small village farming communities would have found that they had essentially less space in which to secure their livelihoods. Large parts of the landscape would have become uninhabitable and unproductive, and people would have been forced into what we might refer to as environmental refugia, essentially river valleys, drying up lakes, highland regions where there was still a remaining amount of rainfall. And so we see increases in human populations in these environmental refuges, and this is where the first civilization has developed.
So instead of thinking of as a great step forward because we could, it was, if you like, a last resort.
Yeah, I'd say that civilization is the product of a complex series of last resorts, and really it's probably a condition of humanity in extremis. At least that's how it started. Obviously, once civilization got going, it developed its own momentum, and I don't want to be too deterministic about this and claim that all civilization is the result of climate change, or whenever you get climate change, you get civilization springing up. All I'm saying is that if we go back to between about 4,000 and 6,000 years ago, the earliest civilizations appeared to be emerging as the environment became more arid, and there's a lot of archaeological and paleo-environmental evidence that suggests that this was in large part a response to this environmental deterioration.
How have you been investigating this evidence yourself?
Well, I first started thinking along these lines as a result of work I was doing in the Sahara. My background's actually in climatology, and I became involved in an archaeological project in southern Libya. And in this part of the Sahara, we see very clear trajectories of linked environmental and cultural change. When you're standing in the Sahara and you're looking at a grinding stone that somebody once used to process grains for food, and you're actually in the middle of a sand sea that's completely uninhabitable, it's pretty obvious that something dramatic has been going on. And so the Sahara has been described as a laboratory of adaptation. It's somewhere where we can really look at what was going on because the signals are so clear and the changes were so dramatic. So through years of work in the Sahara, myself and other colleagues developed these ideas, and this is, you know, not particularly controversial amongst the archaeological community working in North Africa. However, I then decided to look at what was going on in other parts of the world, and so I essentially read all the papers and tried to do a bit of a synthesis, and I found that we have similar processes occurring where we have the other civilizations growing up.
That hasn't really been quite so obvious before. I mean, if you look at the Fertile Crescent, it's not at all fertile now. It's a bloody great big desert, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I guess there's something in that. Certainly it was fertile once upon a time. I think, going back to the origins of the term, it's probably because people knew this is where agriculture developed, and there are certain places, obviously there's more or less a crescent, including the Nile and the sort of coastal plains and river valleys, where people did migrate to as the place became more arid. And so these are fertile refuges in an otherwise arid landscape. But yes, it is quite ironic, because it's only after this part of the world became less fertile that we see these civilizations emerging.
Any idea whether it's as a result, perhaps to some extent anyway, of agriculture and the change to the soil and so on?
I think not. There's been a lot of suggestions about, you know, over-exploitation of the landscape. People have even suggested that the Sahara became a desert because of overgrazing. And this goes on today. People talk a lot about overgrazing in parts of Africa like the Sahel and how this has driven drought. All the scientific evidence that we have suggests that these very large-scale changes were driven by natural climate variability and not by over-exploitation of the landscape.
Okay, so what are you going to do to take this further in your investigation?
I'm going to continue my work in the Sahara, which is my own particular area of expertise, and I'm currently running a project in the disputed territory of Western Sahara. So that's a very interesting experience. We have to travel there through Algeria to work in the zone administered by the Polisario Independence Movement, the rest being occupied by Morocco. So I'm going to continue the work there.
You're a brave man.
Well, yes, it's nice to get away from it all. There aren't many tourists there for a start. So, but I'm going to encourage my colleagues in the fields of archaeology and past environmental change to really start looking in more detail at what's happening at the very local level in terms of linked trajectories of environmental and cultural change. Because it's one thing to say, well, we've got this going on with the environment, at the same time we've got this happening culturally, but that's really just an exercise in matching up timings. We want to really start looking in more detail at the processes by which these civilizations emerged so that we can really see if this was precisely what was going on.
Nick Brooks from the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change, University of East Anglia. Chocolate, endowed with all sorts of qualities. And in Occam's Razor coming up next weekend, the suggestion that it may be a good treatment for hypochondria. Yasmin Haskell in Perth has been translating some of the 17th century poems of a Tuscan Jesuit with delicious results.
Well, we're always told not to do retrospective diagnosis, but in fact I'm collaborating with a professor of psychiatry at the University of Western Australia, to whom I showed some of this initial research on hypochondria, and he happens to be a psychiatrist and neurologist and deals with real-life hypochondriacal patients today. And my question about the ethics of lying to hypochondriacal patients being such a live issue for psychiatrists today shows one avenue perhaps in which this research could be useful for modern science. That is, if you go back and look at the way people communicated about hypochondria or melancholy, the way they divided up diseases in the past, the way that they understood their illness and managed their illness, it may be possible to draw lessons either from their success or failures, or the success or failure of their doctors, for modern treatments. But obviously it's not a sort of a direct correspondence, because today's hypochondria is a very, very different illness from what these Jesuits were talking about in the 17th century.
What about chocolate? Presumably it hadn't been on the scene for very long at that stage.
Yes, it was still a bit of a novelty, and certainly in the second book of his chocolate poem, Strozzi alludes to a marvellous jasmine-scented chocolate recipe which the great Aretine scientist and physician to the Grand Duke in Tuscany, Francesco Redi, was keeping under wraps. So there was certainly still an almost alchemical mystique around chocolate. And certainly Strozzi doesn't come out in favour or against the use of chocolate as a cure for hypochondria, but he rehearses interesting arguments for and against. This in itself is very intriguing, because as a Jesuit, he really shouldn't have been involving himself in medicine. Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuits, proscribed the practice of medicine for his priests. So this is all an extremely interesting and mysterious thing, that he should be writing this poem on the medicinal benefits of chocolate. Unfortunately, the full mystery won't be solved until the Archivio di Stato, the state archives in Naples, makes available the archives of the 17th century Society of Jesus, which they've either lost or haven't decided to reveal to the world. But there are certainly a lot of scholars like me who'd love to get their hands on them.
Professor Yasmin Haskell, University of Western Australia, presents Occam's Razor next weekend, that's the 19th of November, on hypochondria and chocolate. And still on psychology, do you ever ask a child a question and then say, "Look at me, look at me," before the poor thing can actually give an answer while staring them in the eye? Well, Gwyneth Doherty-Sneddon says that's not a very good idea.
Well, what first triggered our interest in gaze aversion when children look away from faces was our findings that sometimes for some tasks, encouraging children to look at faces is actually bad for their task performance. So most of the time, visual communication cues are very beneficial to us and indeed really help children communicate and understand things. But when they're doing certain types of things and at certain points within interactions, the face-to-face contact can actually interfere with their abilities to do the tasks. And that's what got us interested in looking at when they were looking away from faces to avoid that.
So how did you test that?
One experiment that we did was we got children to remember some visuospatial information for a few seconds, and we either asked them to look at faces during that retention interval or not. And we found that just looking at faces while trying to do that interfered with how many correct things they remembered about the stimuli we were asking them to remember.
Yeah, I remember at school, particularly with fairly authoritarian teachers, they asked you a question, all you could see is their beady eyes, and you had no idea what their mouths were actually saying. And so I suppose there's that effect. But how much pause do you think a younger child requires?
If it's a challenging question, that children can take several seconds to come up with a response. It might be even 6 seconds, which seems and feels like a very long time. When you've asked a question, if you sit there in silence, it feels like a long time. And we don't really like big silences in conversation. That's partly why adults tend to jump in too quickly when they do ask children questions. And often we see parents and teachers interrupting children after only a second, which is no time at all to really let a child think through something.
And so do they actually become more skillful at answering questions if they are given the time that it's required?
Yes, absolutely. We know from educational research that if children are given enough what we call thinking time, that that actually benefits their learning. And from our own studies, we've shown that if we encourage children to look away from faces when thinking, that the response accuracy actually increases.
Have you actually talked to the children about it, asked them what they think?
We have actually, and I've got a lovely little anecdote from a six-year-old child who had been answering questions, either looking at an experimenter's face and other questions looking at the floor. And we asked her afterwards which conditions she'd found easier, and she said that looking at the floor was easier because when she tipped her head forward, her thoughts fell into her brain better.
I know how she feels. What about the difference between age groups 2, 4, 6, 8?
Even very young children avert the gaze when thinking, but certainly there seems to be very rapid development in this behaviour from about in between the ages of 5, 6 and 7. Now, all of our children that we've studied so far have been Scottish children who happen to start school around about their 5th birthdays. So it could be that some of that development is about starting school.
Any thoughts about adults and a similar kind of syndrome?
Adults do exactly the same thing. Adults avert the gaze too in order to manage cognitive load, and the harder questions that you ask an adult, the more likely they are to avert their gaze, and it does seem to help adults remember and answer better and so on. So we get the same sorts of patterns in adults, and indeed even adults who are normally very good at doing auditory attention shifting and things, even adults, if you ask them hard questions, they cannot help but avert their gaze and have great fun doing this with people, because people think that they can control their gaze aversion behaviour. But if you ask them difficult questions and they do make an honest attempt at answering, they really can't help but avert their gaze.
I suppose there would be cultural differences as well. In some societies it's very rude to look and you have to avert your gaze as a matter of course. Have you looked into that at all?
We haven't, but there are big cultural differences in terms of explicit rules about when and how much you're allowed to gaze. So I'm sure that baseline levels of gaze aversion probably will change across cultures, but what I'd expect is that we'll get the same overall patterns.
What were you like as a kid? Did you answer quickly?
I really am. Now let me think
about
it.
You can't remember that far back.
I can't remember that far back, and I'm averting my gaze now. I tried very hard at school, and I think we all have memories of being told as children to look at me when I'm talking to you kind of thing, and I think these kinds of memories stick in people's heads. And when we talk to people about gaze aversion and so on, they say, yes, I can remember being told that and how unfair it was and whatever. And it really is important as adults that we remember that children should be looking at us when they're listening to us, but that it's all right for them to look away when they're thinking.
So remember that when you're giving the kids the beady eye. Gwyneth Doherty-Sneddon at Stirling University in Scotland. Next week on The Science Show, how fish and birds in schools or flocks move as one. Is there a leader? And Dennis Noble on the music of life. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams with plenty of chocolate.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.